The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 11th, 2014 edition of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Obamacare crosses its first hurdle. What happened? President Obama declared victory this week as the first open enrollment period of the Affordable Care Act came to an end, amid a last-minute sign-up surge that pushed enrollment in private health insurance plans beyond 7.1 million, higher than the White House's original goal for the first year. "Armageddon has not arrived," said Obama in a Rose Garden ceremony, in reference to Republican predictions that Obamacare would be a disaster. "Instead, this law is helping millions of Americans, and in the coming years it will help millions more." The law required individuals to have health insurance by March 31st or face a fine of the greater of either $95 or 1% of their taxable income. The technical meltdown of the healthcare.gov website in October meant that only 106,000 people were able to sign up in the opening month of the state and federal exchanges. In just the final week of enrollment, 1 million signed up. "The Affordable Care Act is here to stay," Obama said. "The lengths Republicans have gone to scare people, I don't get it." Republicans greeted the latest enrollment figures with skepticism, pointing out that the Obama administration had given no details about how many of the 7.1 million were previously uninsured or had actually paid for policies. "We don't know, of course, exactly what they have signed up for," said Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. "We don't know how many have paid. The administration expects millions more to sign up in the next open enrollment period in the exchanges starting November 15th. What the editorial said. "Suddenly, Obamacare is a roaring success," said the Wall Street Journal. "But there are more than a few reasons to doubt this new fairy tale. Though the White House claims to have hit its original sign-up target, these unverified numbers say nothing about the Affordable Care Act's long-term viability. To determine that, the administration needs to disclose some crucial contextual data, such as whether enough young, healthy people have signed up to keep insurance prices from spiking next year. Clearly, a lot of Americans really, really want health insurance," said San Jose Mercury News. "On top of the 7.1 million who signed up on the exchanges, another 4.5 million Americans signed up for Medicaid under the ACA's expansion of eligibility, and 3 million young adults ages 18 to 25 gained insurance under their parents' coverage. The ACA may be imperfect, but it's providing millions of Americans with security of knowing they won't lose health insurance if they lose their jobs or get sick." What the columnist said. "It was never going to be hard to reduce the uninsured," said James Capretta in NationalReview.com. "Offer massive public subsidies, as Obamacare does, and people who couldn't afford insurance before will come running. But at what price? For every newly insured American, there are several others, and as many as 5 million in total, who are now getting far worse coverage than they did last year, with higher premiums and higher deductibles. The trade-offs are real and significant," said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com, "but they are worth it. Obamacare will save literally millions of people from being bankrupted by uncovered medical costs, while lowering the cost of medical spending at the same time by giving doctors and hospitals incentives to be more efficient. Republicans simply can't admit any of these benefits are real, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, because it threatens their theological certainty that Obamacare will fail. The news of the enrollment surge has left them stunned and sputtering that surely the White House is cooking the books. Round one of this battle is over, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com, but it will continue for years. The earliest Republicans can hope to repeal the ACA is 2017, and then only if they hold both Congress and the White House. By then, there will be an estimated 24 million Americans in Obamacare's private insurance plans and 12 million covered by Medicaid expansion. Does that make the law invulnerable? No, but it makes it a mighty big nut to crack. And our second main story this week, climate report offers a grim forecast. What happened? A United Nations panel of the world's leading environmental scientists issued its most dire warning yet this week on the dangers posed by climate change, saying global warming is already affecting every continent and threatens to devastate food supplies, cause mass extinctions of plants and animals, worsen droughts, and raise the risk of wars over resources. The longer society holds off on cutting emissions of planet-heating greenhouse gases, said the report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the greater the damage will be. Nobody on this planet is going to be untouched by the impacts of climate change, said panel chairman Rajendra Pachauri. Scientists said that rising oceans and droughts could displace hundreds of millions of people by the end of this century, causing trillions of dollars of damage. Surging temperatures have already lowered corn and wheat yields, the report noted, and farmers could soon struggle to meet the world's food demands. The 2,500-page report was released at a critical time, as governments prepare to negotiate a new deal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that is scheduled to be finalized by the end of 2015. To have any major impact, the agreement would need the cooperation of the U.S., which never ratified the 1997 Kyoto Climate Accord, and major energy users from the developing world, particularly China and India. What the editorial said: the alarming report should be a call to action, said the Los Angeles Times. There is now overwhelming scientific evidence that climate change is radically altering our planet. The mountain snowpack in the western U.S. is shrinking, reducing the country's water supply. Heat waves are becoming more frequent and more intense. If we care about the world we're leaving our children, we will now take serious steps to cut carbon emissions. But man-made global warming is still a theory, not established science, said the Washington Examiner. Yes, the average global temperature did rise through much of the last century. But from 1997 to 2012, the temperature remained static, even as Chinese power plants pumped out tons of supposedly planet-warming carbon dioxide. The facts always seem to contradict the dire observations of global warming alarmists. What the columnist said: climate change is clearly real, said Matt Ridley in the Wall Street Journal. But the debate now is between the alarmist and the lukewarmers, who think its impact will be nowhere near as extreme as this report claims. New research suggests that our climate is less sensitive to carbon emissions than previously thought, which means the planet might warm by just 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the next century, less than half the rise predicted by the panel. Replacing fossil fuels with expensive solar and wind energy to combat this modest warming would be the economic equivalent of taking chemotherapy for a cold. That false optimism is dangerous, said Phil Plait in Slate.com. By cutting our carbon emissions, phasing out dirty coal-burning power plants, and improving vehicle fuel efficiency, we can slow climate change's worst effects, giving us time to figure out what steps to take. But if we listen to the skeptics and do nothing, the results will prove disastrous. We will all have to make sacrifices to survive the crisis, said Simon Jenkins in TheGuardian.com. Environmentalists will have to drop their opposition to genetically modified crops designed to cope with droughts. Conservatives, meanwhile, will have to accept that the developing world will need billions more dollars in aid, unless they want to be inundated with climate refugees. Nothing can be off limits. Sadly, the world remains unwilling to act, said Philip Bump in TheAtlantic.com. Developing nations such as China and India are expected to build more than 1,000 coal-burning power plants in the next few years to meet the electricity demands of their fast-growing economies. Western governments could pass policies that would reduce emissions, but won't, out of fear of angering voters with higher energy bills. After all, it's always easier to shell out money for a disaster that has already happened. And our controversy of the week, college sports. Should athletes be permitted to unionize? The NCAA may finally be getting what it deserves, said Andrew Klein in the USA Today. College sports have grown into a billion-dollar industry, but the NCAA and its member colleges have very deliberately set up rules ensuring they don't have to share a penny of those revenues with their student athletes. That exploitive relationship may soon end. In a ruling that could and should change college athletics forever, if it survives appeals, a regional director of the National Labor Relations Board ruled last week that the members of the Northwestern University football team are employees who have the right to form a union and bargain for a better deal. The NLRB found that players in the major programs are athletes first, students second, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. They spend up to 60 hours a week in arduous practice and workouts. In return, those with scholarships get food, lodging, and tuition. They work for pay, in other words, and are thus entitled to the same protections as other workers, including the right to unionize. A college is not a farm field, said Sally Jenkins in the Washington Post, and college athletes are hardly exploited crop pickers. They are highly privileged scholarship winners who get a lot of valuable stuff for free, including world-class medical care and training, and the chance to develop emotionally, intellectually, and physically at a fine university they might not otherwise attend. The full cost of tuition, room, and board at Northwestern, for example, is $63,000 a year, or $252,000 for 4 years. If players are employees, is that really a poor rate of exchange for playing football or basketball? Yes, there are injustices in how the NCAA treats players, but unionizing and paying them would open a Pandora's box. Man, oh man, just think of the unintended or unimagined consequences, said Gordon Monson in the Salt Lake Tribune. If free tuition becomes a form of income, who's going to pay the tax on it? Could an entire team decide to sell its services to a better-paying college? And should lacrosse players and women athletes who do not draw income-producing audiences get the same salaries as star football quarterbacks? Now, it's not fair that some college coaches get paid $5 million a year off the labor of their unpaid players, or that colleges can profit off autographed photos of their athletes while the athletes cannot. But if the NLRB and courts ultimately rule that players are employees, it may take a decade to sort out the resulting legal chaos. The NCAA can avert the worst-case scenarios, said BloombergView.com in an editorial, but only if it takes this ruling as a wake-up call. It's time to start treating the players fairly. The NLRB pointed out that colleges can withdraw athletic scholarships at any time, thus giving them total leverage over players, who get booted from school if they're injured or disappoint the coach. So the NCAA should immediately make all scholarships guaranteed for 4 years. Another idea would be to give football and basketball players a share of the revenue their teams generate and keep it in a trust fund until they graduate, said John Feinstein in the Washington Post. But the financial issues are really secondary. This case is about reforming a system in which players are treated like serfs, with their lives utterly controlled by dictatorial coaches who, at Northwestern, told the quarterback his classwork was getting in the way of football. The Northwestern players aren't demanding to be paid, much as they may deserve it. They are simply demanding a voice. Well, it was a good week for reptile experience. After a Michigan firefighter who'd handled snakes as a teen ran into a burning home and carefully rescued a 6-foot-long python. None of the other firefighters wanted anything to do with it, said Scott Hammelsbach. It was a good week for breathing deeply. After a Chinese travel company shipped bags of fresh mountain air to the smog-choked city of Jingzhou as a treat for residents. I felt my baby move right away when I breathed in, said a pregnant woman who waited online for a sniff. Painless budget cuts, it was a good week for. After 14-year-old Suvir Mirchandani of Pittsburgh calculated that government agencies could save $370 million a year in ink and paper cost by printing all documents in the thinner Garamond typeface instead of Times New Roman. It was a bad week for the Ukrainian Navy. After the Russian military seized control of the country's Combat Dolphin program, which had been based in Crimea, Dolphins get used to the people they work with, said a Ukrainian official. It's not easy for them to change allegiance. It was a bad week for driving with kids, after police got a 911 call about a woman's screams issuing from a Massachusetts man's car and surrounded him. Instead of finding a woman in distress, officers discovered several goats in the back seat and let him go. It was a bad week for ordering a margarita after heavy rains, tree disease, and cartel violence sent prices for Mexico's limes soaring from $14 a case to $100. We don't buy them anymore, said the owner of a San Antonio Mexican restaurant. We substitute lemons. And while we're on this page, here's a boring but important note on Ryan's austerity budget. Representative Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, this week unveiled an election year budget plan that would cut spending by $5.1 trillion over the next decade and repeal the Affordable Care Act. The blueprint, designed to appeal to the party's base in the run-up to the November midterms, would cut Medicaid and health care spending for the poor by $732 billion, Medicare by $129 billion, and food stamps by $125 billion. The goal is to empower recipients to get off the aid rolls and back on the payroll, said Ryan. He also proposed adding $483 billion to military spending. Representative Steve Israel of New York, chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, said his party will make Ryan's scandalous plan the centerpiece of this year's campaign. And we'll turn over now to the briefing page. The mainstreaming of mindfulness. Stressed out Americans, from war veterans to Google workers, are embracing meditation. Does it really work? Why is mindfulness so popular? It appeals to people seeking an antidote to life in a work-obsessed, tech-saturated, frantically busy Western culture. There is growing scientific evidence that mindfulness meditation has genuine health benefits and can even alter the structure of the brain. So the technique is drawing some unlikely devotees. Pentagon leaders are experimenting with mindfulness to make soldiers more resilient, while General Mills has installed a meditation room in every building of its Minneapolis campus. Even tech-obsessed Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are using it as a way to unplug from their hyper-connected lives. Meditation always had bad branding for this culture, said Evan Williams, co-founder of Twitter. But to me, it's a way to think more clearly and to not feel so swept up. What is mindfulness exactly? It's a meditation practice central to the Buddha's teachings, which has now been adapted by Western teachers into a secular self-help technique. One of the pioneers in the field is Jon Kabat-Zinn, an MIT-educated molecular biologist who began teaching mindfulness in the 1970s to people suffering from chronic pain and disease. The core of mindfulness is quieting the mind's constant chattering, thoughts, anxieties, and regrets. Practitioners are taught to keep their attention focused on whatever they're doing at the present moment, whether it's eating, exercising, or even working. The most basic mindfulness practice is sitting meditation. You sit in a comfortable position, close your eyes, and focus your awareness on your breath or other bodily sensations. When thoughts come, you gently let them go without judgment and return to the focus on the breath. Over time, this practice helps people connect with a deeper, calmer part of themselves and retrain their brains not to get stuck in pointless, neurotic ruminations about the past and future that leave them constantly stressed, anxious, or depressed. Does it work? Scientific research has shown that mindfulness appears to make people both happier and healthier. Regular meditation can lower a person's blood pressure and their levels of cortisol, a stress hormone produced by the adrenal gland and closely associated with anxiety. Meditation can also increase the body's immune response, improve a person's emotional stability and sleep quality, and even enhance creativity. When combining mindfulness with traditional forms of cognitive behavioral therapy, patients in one study saw a 10 to 20% improvement in the mild symptoms of their depression, the same progress produced by antidepressants. Other studies have found that up to 80% of trauma survivors and veterans with PTSD see a significant reduction in troubling symptoms. Walter Reed National Military Medical Center is also teaching mindfulness as a form of treatment for patients with substance abuse problems. Why does it work? MRI scans have shown that mindfulness can alter the meditator's brain waves and even cause lasting changes to the physical structure of their brains. Meditation reduces electrical activity and blood flow in the amygdala, a brain structure involved in strong primal emotions such as fear and anxiety, while boosting activity regions responsible for planning, decision-making, and empathy. These findings have helped attract the more skeptical-minded, There is a swath of our culture who is not going to listen to someone in monk's robes, said Richard J. Davidson, founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds, but they are paying attention to scientific evidence. Who are these converted skeptics? Ironically enough, Silicon Valley's tech geeks are leading the way. It seems counterintuitive, since technology is perhaps the biggest driver of mindlessness and distraction, says Ann Mack, a director at marketing communications brand JWT Worldwide. Google now has an in-house mindfulness program called Search Inside Yourself, and the company has even installed a labyrinth at its Mountain View complex so employees can practice walking meditation. Tech leaders flock annually to the Wisdom 2.0 conference, and there are now countless smartphone apps devoted to the subject. But these developments have led to a growing concern that mindfulness is being co-opted and corrupted. Why is that? Long-term adherents of mindfulness worry that what is fundamentally a spiritual practice is being appropriated by New Age entrepreneurs seeking to profit off it. Others are concerned that Fortune 500 executives are pushing meditation so that overworked employees can be even more productive without melting down. But Westerners clearly need some sort of strategy to cope with a world now filled with the inescapable distractions of technology. The average American now consumes 63 gigabytes of content, or more than 150,000 words, over 13.6 hours of media use every single day. And all indications are that those numbers will keep climbing. For Janice Marchionne-Turano, founder of the Institute for Mindful Leadership, mindfulness is not just a way of coping with the deluge of input. It's a way of confronting the modern world head on. There is no life-work balance, said Marturano. We have one life. What's most important is that you be awake for it. We turn now to the best columns from the U.S. Carrie's Deluded Quest by Jackson Deal at the Washington Post. Just 5 months ago, Secretary of State John Kerry boldly claimed the Middle East was on its way to a stunning series of breakthroughs, said Jackson Deal. Thanks to his diplomacy, a roadmap to democracy was being carried out in Egypt. In Syria, peace negotiations would end the brutal civil war. And, most incredibly, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was at last on its way to a final settlement. Some were impressed with Kerry's grand ambition. Others said he was delusional. The verdict is in. Delusional. In Egypt, a military government has reinstalled a repressive dictatorship. In Syria, the slaughter continues unabated. The Israeli-Palestinian quagmire remains just that, despite Kerry's fevered attempts to persuade Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to make a deal that neither wants. Predictably, the two sides haven't budged a millimeter. And now Abbas has publicly rejected Kerry's proposed peace framework, which is essentially dead. What's the alternative to Kerry's zeal for peace deals? Deal with the region's ugly realities. In short, drop the delusions. The GOP's billionaire wild card, from Kenneth B. Vogel at Politico.com. When billionaire casino owner Sheldon Adelson summons Republican presidential hopefuls for an audience, said Kenneth P. Vogel, they come running. Adelson, who threw more than $90 million at Republican candidates and super PACs in the last election cycle, hosted the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference in Las Vegas last week. Possible 2016 candidates Jeb Bush and Governors Chris Christie of New Jersey, John Kasich of Ohio, and Scott Walker of Wisconsin all auditioned for Adelson's favor. Now that political contributions are virtually unlimited, a handful of donors can dramatically alter a campaign with just a check or two. So GOP operatives and candidates lavished praise on Adelson, 80, as he zipped around his gaudy faux Venetian kingdom on a motor scooter. In their speeches, all the presidential hopefuls stressed their unwavering support for Israel, a prime criterion for Adelson's support. Christie, in fact, personally apologized to Adelson after he referred to the occupied territories in the West Bank. Adelson considers them a permanent part of Israel. Who left Vegas with the best shot at Adelson's boundless financial support? He wasn't saying. As one longtime confidant put it, Sheldon makes up his own mind. Jailing Women Who Have Miscarriages, from Nina Martin at ProPublica.org. Rennie Gibbs was 16 years old when she gave birth to a premature stillborn child, said Nina Martin. The apparent cause of death was the umbilical cord wrapped around the infant's neck, but a medical examiner found traces of cocaine in Gibbs' blood, and the teen was indicted for murder. 7 years later, after much legal wrangling, Gibbs may soon go on trial in a case Right to Life advocates see as a test case for the rights of the unborn child. If Gibbs is convicted, it could trigger a wave of similar prosecutions of women in red states, where poverty produces high rates of miscarriage and child mortality. With increasing frequency, authorities in these states are charging women with crimes for endangering their unborn children. An Indiana woman, for example, was jailed for a year for attempting suicide while she was pregnant. And an Iowa woman was arrested after falling down a flight of stairs and suffering a miscarriage. But threats to jail young pregnant women who are in trouble will only make them less likely to seek medical care or help. Is this the kind of society we want? We turn now to the last word, our in-depth article. This week titled, The Parenting Paradox. Being a parent of young kids can be very rewarding, said Jennifer Senior, but it can also make you crazy. When I first met Jesse Thompson, it was mid-March, a trying time for Minnesota parents. Everywhere else in the country, spring had sprung. Here, it would be at least another month before the kids could be humanely disgorged into the yard. All week long, I attended early childhood family education classes in and around Minneapolis and St. Paul, listening to roughly 125 parents talk about their lives. And all week long, almost all would give the same report. Their nerves were shot, and so were their kids' toys. The Play-Doh reduced to dry chips, the Legos scattered in house-wide diaspora. Minnesota's ECFE is immensely popular and unique to the state. Any parent of a child who's not yet in kindergarten can attend a weekly class, and they do in great numbers. In 2010, nearly 90,000 moms and dads signed up for one. The themes of classes vary, but what they all have in common is an opportunity for parents to confide, learn, and let off steam. The first half of each class is straightforward, with parents and children interacting in a group facilitated by ECFE's staff of early childhood education professionals. But the second half, that's when things get interesting. The parents leave their kids in the hands of those same professionals and retreat to a room of their own, where for 60 blissful minutes they become grown-ups again. Coffee is consumed, hair is let down, notes are compared. A parent educator always guides the discussion. I met Jessie in one of the smaller ECFE classes. Her contributions to the discussion, while often wry, also suggested that she wasn't afraid of her darker, spikier feelings, and that she could even take a dispassionate view of them. For instance, she mentioned that she'd managed to get out of the house the previous evening to meet a girlfriend, a triumph considering she had 3 kids under the age of 6. "And I had this moment," she said, "where I realized this is how it feels when moms run away from their kids. I could see why moms get in their cars and just keep driving." She was not seriously entertaining this idea. Jessie was clearly a secure mother, which was why she was comfortable enough to confess this fleeting vision aloud. It was also clear, though, that she was dead tired and not a little overwhelmed. She was trying to expand her new portrait photography business, based in the den of her home. She was living paycheck to paycheck. Her youngest was just 8 months old. She didn't have the resources to put her children in ballet classes or soccer, much less something as luxurious as preschool. She couldn't afford a babysitter for so much as one morning a week. Every trip to the grocery store involved loading all 3 kids in the car. One day, you are a paragon of self-determination, coming and going as you please. The next, you are a parent, laden with gear and unhooked from the rhythms of normal adult life. It's not an accident that the early years of parenting often register in studies as the least happy ones. They're the bunker years, short in the scheme of things, but often endless seeming in real time. The autonomy that parents once took for granted has curtly deserted them, a fact that came up again and again among ECFE parents. Few people talked about this before and after with more honesty or descriptive power than Jessie. In her early 20s, she had taught English in Germany, worked at a pub in England, and done a brief stint as a flight attendant for Delta. Now she was spending her days in a 1,700-square-foot bungalow with one bathroom. In her late 20s, she had decided she wanted a career in advertising, and she was well en route to one by the time her first child was born. Now she was presiding over a new, family-friendlier business, so she assumed, her peaceful downtown office replaced by a boisterous niche across from the TV room. "I really, really struggle with this still," she told her group. "It was just me and my husband until I was 32. Having children enlarges our lives in loads of unimaginable ways, but it also disrupts our autonomy in ways we couldn't have imagined, whether it's in our work, our leisure, or the banal routines of our day-to-day lives. One of the advantages to arriving at a household at 8 a.m. is that you can read in the parents' faces the story of both that morning and the evening before. When I visit Jessie in her South Minneapolis home, her husband, a civil engineer, is already long gone for work. But she's here, and she's tired. It's clear that she either woke up early or went to bed late. It turns out the answer is both. "Before you got here, I was so depressed," she confesses, shutting the door behind me. Bella, 5, and Abe, 4, are both padding about, merry and oblivious to their mother's exhaustion, while the baby, William, is asleep upstairs. "The baby got up early," she explains, "and the others were up early, too. And then the baby threw up on one of his stuffed animals. At roughly the same moment, Abe wet the bed, which meant the sheets had to be changed and he had to be bathed. Then William started spitting up juice in spectacular projectile fashion at breakfast. This was at 7:37, she says. "I know because I was thinking, it's way too early for everything to be falling apart." Which explains why she was up early. Why she was up late the night before is another story. Nighttime is Jessie's one opportunity for uninterrupted work, and she has an afternoon deadline today. Plus, she was fretting. She and her family will soon be decamping to the suburbs in order to cut costs, but she doesn't know a soul in her new community. Between her worries and her work, she didn't climb into bed until 3 a.m. On some mornings, Jessie admits, she's so exhausted that the most she can do is set bowls of Cheerios and a cup of milk on the kitchen counter and then return to bed. I do know a couple of moms who get enough sleep, she said. I always wonder how they do it, because I sure don't. Of all the torments of new parents, sleeplessness is the most infamous. But most parents-to-be, no matter how much they've been warned, don't fully grasp this idea until their first child comes along. Perhaps that's because they think they know what sleep deprivation feels like. But there's a profound difference between sustained sleep loss and the occasional bad night. David Dinges, an expert on sleep deprivation, says that the population seems to divide roughly into thirds when it comes to prolonged sleep loss. Those who handle it fairly well, those who sort of fall apart, and those who respond catastrophically. The problem is, most prospective parents have no clue which type they are until their kids come along. Adam Phillips makes a keen observation in his book, Going Sane. Babies may be sweet, babies may be beautiful, babies may be adored, he writes, but they have all the characteristics that are identified as mad when they are found too brazenly in adults. He lists those characteristics. Babies are incontinent. They don't speak our language. They require constant monitoring to prevent self-harm. They seem to live the excessively wishful lives, he notes, of those who assume they are the only person in the world. The same is true, Philip goes on to argue, of young children who want so much and possess so little self-control. Yet children do not see themselves as excessive. Children would be very surprised, Philip writes, to discover just how mad we think they are. The real danger, in his view, is that children can drive their parents crazy. The extravagance of children's wishes, behaviors, and energies all become a threat to their parents' well-ordered lives. This insight helps clarify why parents so often feel powerless around their young children, even though they're putatively in charge. To a preschooler, all rumpus room calisthenics, whether it's bouncing from couch cushion to couch cushion, banging on tables, or heaving bowls of spaghetti onto the floor, feel normal. But to adults, the child looks as though he or she has suddenly slipped into one of Maurice Sendak's wolf suits. The grown-up response is to put a stop to the child's mischief. But that's the adult's job, and that's what civilized living is all about. Yet parents intuit, on some level, that children are meant to make messes, to be noisy, to test boundaries. All parents at some time feel overwhelmed by their children, feel that their children ask more of them than they can provide, writes Phillips. One of the most difficult things about being a parent is that you have to bear the fact that you have to frustrate your child. There are biological underpinnings that help explain why young children drive us crazy. Adults have a fully developed prefrontal cortex, while the prefrontal cortexes of young children are barely developed at all. The prefrontal cortex controls executive function, which allows us to organize our thoughts, as a result, our actions. Without this ability, we cannot focus our attention. And this, in some ways, is one of the most frustrating aspects of dealing with little kids. Their attention is unfocused. But again, children themselves do not perceive their attention as unfocused. The psychologist Alison Gopnik makes a distinction between a lantern and a spotlight. The spotlight illuminates just one thing, while the lantern throws off a 360-degree glow. Adults have a spotlight consciousness. The consciousness of small children, on the other hand, is more like a lantern. By design, infants and preschoolers are highly distractible, like bugs with eyes all over their heads. And because the prefrontal cortex controls inhibitions as well as executive function, young children lack compunction about investigating every tangential object that captures their fancy. Anyone who tries to persuade a 3-year-old to get dressed for preschool will develop an appreciation of inhibition, she writes. It would be so much easier if they didn't stop to explore every speck of dust on the floor. Mothers and fathers believe that if only they could convey the logic of their decisions, their young children would understand it. But young children lead intensely emotional lives. Reasoned discussion does not have the same effect on them, and their brains are not yet optimized for it. I do make the mistake of talking to my daughter sometimes like she's an adult, a woman named Kenya confessed to her ECFE group. I expect her to understand, like if I break things down enough, she'll get it. The class instructor nodded sympathetically. It's the little adult problem, he explained. We mistakenly believe our children will be persuaded by our ways of reasoning. But your 3-year-old, he gently told her, is never going to say, "Yes, you're right. You have a point." This article was taken from the book All Joy and No Fun: The Paradox of Modern Parenthood by Jennifer Senior, copyright 2014. Here on the health and science page, the deadly toll of air pollution. Breathing dirty air is a real killer. New findings from the World Health Organization show that air pollution was responsible for more than 7 million global deaths in 2012, making it the world's number one environmental health risk. More than one-third of those deaths occurred in Asia, where rapid industrial development in countries like Japan, China, and India has contributed significantly to the problem. The stark figures were included in a WHO report that also revealed a significant link between exposure to air pollution and cardiovascular diseases. And the dangers extend beyond urban populations to rural areas, with more than half of the deaths, some 4.3 million, attributed to indoor pollutants, mainly from household stoves that burn coal, wood, dung, and crop residues. The resulting fumes contribute to heart disease, strokes, lung cancer, and respiratory infections, and they disproportionately affect poor women and children who spend more time in the home. Toxic air outdoors figured in 3.7 million deaths, and many fatalities were attributable to a combination of both factors. The hardest hit countries were low and middle income nations in Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific region. Few risks have a greater impact on global health today than air pollution, Maria Niera, director of WHO's Public Health Department, tells LiveScience.com. The evidence signals the need for concerted action to clean up the air we breathe. Deep water spill still killing fish. The oil release during the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster may damage fish populations in the Gulf of Mexico for years to come. New research from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration found that exposure to crude oil can cause heart defects in fish embryos, abnormalities that will likely kill many developing fish and shorten the lives of others. The study looked at bluefin and yellowfin tuna and amberjacks, key commercial and ecological species. You mess up the heart, you mess up the ability of species like this to do simple functions like swim and catch prey. Environmental toxicologist Fernando Galvez tells CNN.com. The April 2010 accident, which unleashed some 4.1 million barrels of oil into the Gulf, coincided with the spawning season, when fragile embryos would have been floating on the surface. The study mimicked real-life events, exposing developing fish to oil collected from the deep-water source pipe and surface skimming operations. Defects included physical distortions in the hearts, body shapes, and eyes of embryos. BP disputed the findings, saying researchers exposed the fish to higher concentrations of oil than were seen in the wild. But scientists maintain that even minimal exposure to petrochemicals resulted in critical malformations. Over on the Talking Points page, Bridgegate. Christie points the finger of blame. The Bridgegate internal review is in, said Alec McGillis in NewRepublic.com, and not surprisingly, it lets Chris Christie off the hook. The 360-page, $1 million taxpayer-funded whitewash commissioned by the New Jersey governor on September's lane closures at the George Washington Bridge exonerates him from any responsibility whatsoever for the act of political spite. Instead, the report lays the blame solely on two people, Bridget Kelly, Christie's former deputy chief of staff, and David Wildstein, a Christie appointee to the Port Authority. Both are accused of conspiring to punish the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee for failing to endorse Christie for re-election by jamming up traffic in his town for days, and all without Christie ever knowing a thing. Well, then, if the people being paid $650 per hour by Christie say so, it must be true. So now we know Christie's strategy. Blame Bridget, said John Walsh in Salon.com. In a demonstration of textbook misogyny, the report depicts the loyal staffer, a divorced mother of four, as an emotional liar who acted hysterically in the aftermath of an affair with another top Christie aide. By trying to personally humiliate Kelly, Christie only proves once again that he's a bully. Everyone knows this. Internal review is irrelevant, said Michael Tomosky in thedailybeast.com. Christie commissioned it only so he could launch a preemptive strike against credibility of Kelly and Wildstein, who he's worried will testify against him in the only investigation that matters, the one being conducted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Federal investigators are trying to find out whether Christie is lying and knew something about the lane closures. Liberals aren't interested in the truth about Bridgegate, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. They rightly fear Christie as a presidential candidate who could beat Hillary Clinton. And while they'll dismiss this internal report, the investigators did interview 70 people and examine 250,000 documents, finding zero evidence of Christie's involvement. Still, putting Bridgegate in the governor's rearview mirror isn't as simple as that, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. The drip, drip, drip of news from the federal investigation will mean this scandal will hover over him throughout 2014 and perhaps well into 2015. That will badly damage Christie's chances of running as the inevitable mainstream GOP choice. Another Talking Points article, Conscious Uncoupling, Rebranding Divorce. After sharing 11 years, two kids, and 8 tons of steamed kale together, Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin are splitting up, said Jan Moir in the Daily Mail. But the Hollywood actress and the Coldplay singer will experience no ordinary, bitter, family-smashing divorce. Oh, no. In an irony-free chunk of classic Paltrow pretentiousness, The self-appointed lifestyle guru announced via her website, goop.com, last week that she and Chris would instead consciously uncouple. While co-parenting their two children, Apple, 9, and Moses, 7, from the comfort of their new $14 million Malibu home, the pair will work on spiritually separating without judgment, in the kind of holistic experience you'd order at a well-being spa, along with the coffee enema. Underneath that sunny New Age baloney, said Jessica Gross in Slate.com, is the message that accompanies all Goop productions. Even Gwyneth's separation is better than yours. Conscious uncoupling is psychobabble for people who can't say D-I-V-O-R-C-E, said Robin Abkarian in Los Angeles Times. Attached to the couple's announcement was an essay by two doctors explaining that divorce is natural in an era of longer lifespans, since human beings aren't built to stay in love for 50 years. What hogwash! Most divorces occur in the first 10 years of marriage, when two rich, coddled stars can't stay together because they're so used to having everything they want. It's easier to rely on some fake sociobiology than to admit, hey, we screwed up. Still, beneath all goopism is an interesting idea, said Christina Pasoli in HuffingtonPost.com. Now that one in two marriages ends in divorce, maybe it's better to split up without all the toxic acrimony and finger-pointing. And if Gwyneth and Chris can pull off a mature and supportive separation, no one will benefit more than their kids. So let's cut Gwyneth some slack, said Paul Whitefield in the Los Angeles Times. I uncoupled once, and it's very hard. You build your life with someone, and then you tear it all apart. You have to tell your friends, your coworkers, and most painfully, your kids. That hurts whether you're a celebrity or Mr. and Mrs. Joe Sixpack. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.